If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
Here on Reality Check Radio, it's Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. Please send me a text, 2057, email me, inbox@realitycheck.radio. You know how much I love receiving your messages. So please, comments, suggestions, ideas, criticisms, we love it all. Now, property, what a thing it is in New Zealand. What a terrible thing it is in New Zealand in so many ways. Great if you've got it, not so good if you haven't. Well, we've got a lady that's going to help us understand property, understand the market, understand how to invest, but also she's going to share us her philosophy and her life. Good morning, Nicole Lewis. They call you the Queen of Property, but that's not what you call yourself, is it?
Good morning, good morning. First of all, thanks very much for having me. I say I'm the queen of mistakes. When I go around and do keynotes and I get introduced that way, it's like I have made all of the mistakes I think possible. But I always say a mistake is an opportunity to learn. So I've had a huge amount of lessons, which I think is what has earned me.
Isn't that the way?
It
about
is. Look,
life is making mistakes should never be frowned upon.
No, I think mistakes should actually be encouraged. So I've always said to my children, make as many mistakes as you can because they are the best forms of opportunities.
And we spend too much time planning what we're going to do next, thinking of everything that could go wrong, and we're far better just to jump in and fix the mistakes as they happen. And 99% of perceived problems don't occur or are very easy to fix.
Very, very true. I think if we try to get it perfect, we never take any action.
I had a terrible thing of screwing up. I just have a fear of it. And I've had to work very hard to overcome it. And in politics, it was very funny because if I can use a small expletive, it's just shit from the start of the day to the end of things going wrong, right?
Yeah.
Because the only things that come across your desk are things that don't have an answer. And every one of them is sort of catastrophic. But what I quickly discovered was that 90% of it didn't matter. You know what I mean? You just sort of sailed on and got through, and then the bit that did matter, you'd have to fix and take a sort of bit of embarrassment or something over. It's quite surprising. And I found the same since leaving politics that, you know, you go to fix a car or, you know, I don't know anything about cars or build a cabin or something. And you're far better to jump in and just start doing.
Absolutely right. Absolutely.
So tell us, first of all, we're going to talk first of all about why we've got Nicole Lewis on. And then we're going to jump into who Nicole Lewis is. So what's your business?
So we're basically now in the property investment and education business.
Tell
so
me.
we help people get into property. So it's, I mean, look, it's your biggest purchase you'll ever make. Let's face it, you're spending a lot of money. So a little bit of fear is certainly warranted. But the best way to overcome fear and perceived risk in anything, property included, is to simply learn and understand what you're doing.
So if I'm a 25-year-old couple and I'm anxious to get my property, I could learn that how to do that from you.
Correct. Yes, you can.
And I'd pay you some money and you would teach me.
Well, you can do it in a couple of simple ways. I wrote a book called Property Quadrants. So the first thing to do at a very low entry cost is to buy the book. And it splits property into four different quadrants. And therefore, you have a look at there's four different methods of doing property. And so it's a case of ascertaining from the outset, which quadrant are you in? Therefore, which strategy do you apply in the property market?
What's quadrant one?
So quadrant one is the emotional quadrant. that's where you buy your family home.
Yeah.
And your family home is an emotional purchase. And when you purchase something from an emotion standpoint, whether it's a property or whether it's a small consumable, you don't necessarily think about the pros and cons. You just desperately want it. And that's where we can overspend. And in property, that can create some significant financial struggle moving forward.
Well, just dealing with that alone, what's the price of the book?
Also, the book is $29.99, so it's available
and where can...
everywhere, pretty much. WhitCalls, it's online.
Oh, wow.
Everywhere, yeah.
So it's
also,
$30.
It's also audible. It's also audible for people who like me that don't like to read.
So for $30, you can just overcome that and understand that emotional thing. Oh, I just love this house. Oh, I got to have it. Oh, it's $100,000 more than I was prepared to pay. And then you can tie yourself in knots for years ahead.
Correct.
What's quadrant two?
So quadrant two is the cash poor quadrant, otherwise known as the mistake quadrant, where probably about 95% of investors buying their first investment property go into because they don't know any different. So you've got money going out on your family home, and then you go and buy your first investment property and you also have money going out. So you make yourself cash poor. You become accidentally a big, big struggle.
Am I giving away the secret of the book?
Let's give it away. Let's do it. Okay. Let's help as many people as we can.
And presumably in the book, you have a strategy for dealing with each of these quadrants.
I certainly do. And the book's full of real stories and where people have made mistakes and how they've turned themselves around. And it actually explains my complete story as well. All the terrible things laid bare that I've done wrong.
Of a sexual nature?
Well, I did have to keep it a PG content.
Okay. Phew. You got to think of your kids.
Exactly.
Quadrant three, what's that?
Quadrant three is the active income quadrant. So this is how first home buyers, for example, can accelerate making their deposit to buy the house. You know, instead of just saving from your wages or waiting for your KiwiSaver to go up, you can actually make lump sums of cash using property. So the book outlines a number of different ways to do it. And the most common that people have heard of are flipping a property or doing a development. But there's also a lot of no money ways. If you've got no money, you can still do property.
Really?
You can. Yeah.
So, how do you do that?
Well, the two most common no money ways are property finding and what we call contemporaneous deals. In other words, back-to-back settlements. So I, for example, go and find a property that someone wants to buy as an investment or someone wants to renovate and resell, and I simply go and pass that contract on to that person.
So you buy the house first?
So I buy the house first.
I get it
under contract with a condition in there.
Yes.
And then I go and I find a buyer, a property investor who wants to buy it off me, and I might mark the price up by a small amount, like $20,000-$25,000, small amount. And so let's say I buy it for $500,000 on contract. I sell it to them for $525,000, and I make that $25,000, less my legal fees, of course, on the way through. And that's a back-to-back settlement. So it settles on the same day, so I only own it for a minute.
Yes.
Yeah, that's called contemporaneous. That's the most common way of doing. And in property, we call sort of $15,000 to $25,000 a small amount of money.
Okay.
But if you think about if you need $100,000 for a deposit, you could do five of those. And you could do that within a year, but you can't really save $100,000 from your job within a year.
Seems easy when you say it like that.
Does seem easy. It's not like everything, not as simple as it seems. Few.
What was the second way of having no money and getting into the property market?
Second way of doing it is just by doing you can be a property finder. which means that you've got your client first. So you might go to your local property investors association, for example, and meet people. And you get an awful lot of investors there that have been doing it a long time and they just cannot be bothered searching. And they'll say, I want you to go and find this property. They give you signing authority on their entity. You go and you find a property for them and they usually pay you a $5,000 fee. So there's no risk. It's not a back-to-back settlement. You're simply looking for them. So some people like that because zero risk and you found your buyer first. So it's guaranteed once you find the right deal.
I had a friend who made a lot of money in life and he started out in Australia working out where malls and supermarkets would go next. And he would go along and bundle up 25 properties with an option, no money other than getting the legals done. And he'd have an option to buy at a big price all these houses and whatnot. But he only had an option.
Yes.
And then the supermarkets knew to come to him and say, we're looking to build a new supermarket. Oh, yeah, no, I've got options on all these. He made a bomb.
Yes. That's basically a contemporaneous deal on steroids. Perfect.
I don't know. I'm a hardcore capitalist, anarchist in theory, right? But I always feel a bit queasy about being a trader. You know what I mean?
Why?
Well, I guess it's this Protestant thing that it's not really money earned. I know that's silly, right? But I wonder if there's a lot of people in my category.
But why somehow, would you think you haven't earned the money?
Well, because all I did was flick a property and I got 25K.
Mm-hmm.
Like 25K is a year's work in saving. It just seems wrong.
Yeah, but it's a very good point because you go, all I did is flick a property. But that'll probably take you, if you're starting from scratch and you know nothing about property, it'll probably take you 6 months because you have to learn about property. You have to know what you're looking for. Mm. You have to understand how to do the numbers on property. You need to go and build the right networks and connections around you, like your friend who did the options on the supermarkets.
Mm.
He would have had to have built all of those connections and contacts in head office with the people with the supermarkets who make the decisions. Then he has to go out there and look for the property. That stuff's not easy.
While you were talking, it's probably laziness.
We're getting to it.
I'm probably making an excuse for being lazy and not doing that sort of stuff because you're right. Like, you know, you're sort of, it's very easy just to do what you do and not be creative and entrepreneurial, particularly when it comes to property. What's the fourth quadrant?
The fourth quadrant is the passive income quadrant. So that's for property investors to buy what we call cash rich property. So it's the right type of property, which is a multi-income investment property that actually pays you money from day one after you pay your mortgage, your rates, your insurance, your property manager, your maintenance, you've got money left over. That's the type of investment you should buy.
Yes. So you're on the lookout for that.
Correct. So they're hard to find, but they're there. So you might find 20 or 30 three-bedroom, one-bathroom houses to one block of multi-units. So it's just a case of knowing what you're searching for.
So what you're saying is you're not looking for one property that will do that, but a block of flats.
That is correct. But not too big a block of flats because then it becomes a commercial deal. So sort of around three flats, possibly four is what you're after.
What's the difference between a deal and a commercial deal?
Simply put, it's your amount you can borrow. So if it flicks to commercial, not a commercial property, but a commercial deal as far as the bank is concerned.
Okay.
You can borrow less. So you've got to put in a bigger, usually it's about 50%. So you've got to put in a bigger deposit. I'm not opposed to those. Those are brilliant, but they're not the place to start.
Okay. And what about, are we talking solely residential property or also commercial property, like offices?
Solely
and stuff?
Residential, the in the book. It's solely residential. A commercial is a different set of learning altogether.
Have you stuck with residential?
I have. I have. Mm. Yeah.
I've often wondered if commercial would be easier in the sense that you don't get caught up with the risk of a bad tenant and also the crazy laws that we have that are thrown hard against the landlord.
Look, yes, commercial in a lot of sense is easier, especially on a cost basis as well, because your tenant pays all of the costs. And it's definitely good to diversify your portfolio. But commercial breaks down into a number of different segments, you know, whether it's retail, office, industrial, those sorts of things. And so you've got to then know which segment is operating best at the time. Commercial typically gives you a much smaller yield than a residential, and you can borrow a lot less on a commercial.
Okay.
But if you, but like anything, if you buy the right commercial in the right location with the right tenant, you'll do very well. But if you buy the wrong way, you'll also lose money.
So what you're saying is you got to know the right property and the right price, and your book helps you to identify such a property.
Correct. It opens your eyes. The book opens your eyes because typically, look, New Zealanders, we love our house. You know, as a, when we're youngsters growing up, the dream is to get the family home. You know, let's get our house. And so we tend to automatically go to quadrant one. And we dismiss quadrants three and four because we think that that's either too hard or it's for rich people. But actually, quadrants three and four is where the money lies. And you want to get to the point where it's actually feeding quadrant one. So if your family home gets paid for from the excess money you've got left over from your passive income or a lump sum, you know, like when the government brought out non-deductibility and a lot of landlords would start ringing me going, oh my gosh, what do? I need an extra $40,000, $50,000. And I said, fine, we'll go and do one flip and we'll make the money. And that's exactly what you do. So I helped a lot of clients through that. They go and do one flip, they make their $30,000 or $40,000, and then they're like, oh, phew, there's my money for the year to pay the tax. Because you're not going to get your boss at work to give you a $40,000 or $50,000 pay rise.
No, 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 I'm liking. I like the way you talk. Oh, my goodness. You're on Rally Check Radio, Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. We're talking to the Queen of Property, Nicole Lewis, or as she likes to describe herself, the Queen of Mistakes, which is how we all learn the best lessons and the quickest lessons. Buying the book is one way to learn from you. What's the other ways?
So I've got an online training where people can just purchase online, and it's all on videos. So it's all self-paced, self-learning, and all the lessons are there on videos about how to do everything from A to B in property. So if you like to have self-paced and you're quite disciplined, that's a very inexpensive way to learn property. And then I take on a very small number of one-on-one clients that I coach and mentor one-on-one. So, and with that, I guarantee they get a property. I've got two courses now. I just launched a brand new one last week, which is for people that have got no money. So you've got no money in property. I teach you quadrant three. And then my mentoring clients who buy quadrant four become your clients. So that's where you make your money finding them a deal.
Oh, I see.
Yes. So just you don't need to go and look for the buyer now. I've got them.
Isn't that wonderful?
Mm.
Oh, good for you.
So, that's, yeah.
Just explain that to me again.
So
I can be mentored by you into quadrant three, which is how to find a property.
Correct.
And then once I've done that, you have got people to match me with who have got investment funds but can't be bothered finding the property, and your student can go off and find that property, and you've got the match, you're putting the deal together. Correct. How wonderful.
So they learn from me exactly how to find the property, you know, what to look for, how to do the mm-hmm. numbers, how to fill out a sale and purchase agreement, what conditions, everything from me. Once they find the property, they either I buy it myself or one of my mentoring clients in my what we call the property partner program, our top tier, will buy it off them. So they make their finder's fee on the way through.
Well, you're a very competent, clever lady.
Well, it's all about how do I help people with no money? And yeah. that was a product we thought, yeah, that'll do the trick nicely.
And I can find all this on your webpage.
You can.
Which is actually quite easy to find because it's Nicole Lewis.
You can, yes, NicoleLewis.com. Yeah. Yes.
And Nicole
or thepropertylifestyle.com.
Property Lifestyle. Are they the same webpage or are there two webpages?
Two webpages.
Oh, that's got me confused.
I like to confuse.
Nicole Lewis and propertylifestyle.com, two web pages.
Yep.
Now, we want to hear about the mistakes.
Oh, yes.
But we have to go way, way back because you didn't have an average childhood.
No, I certainly didn't.
Tell us.
So when I was one, the grand age of one, my mother was killed in a car accident.
How old was she?
Good question. It was her 25th birthday. She was actually killed on her birthday. She was 25, turned 25.
Was she in the car on her own?
No, we were all in the car. My father, my mother, myself, and apparently I think two family friends. So we were actually in South Africa going to Durban on holiday to celebrate her birthday. And apparently the car came around the corner and went into a truck that was either parked or across the road. I'm not 100% sure. And she was killed instantly.
And so, your father, how was he?
I think he was uninjured. He wasn't driving, luckily, because I don't think he would ever forgive himself if he was. And I think I was uninjured too, from what I obviously heard years later. And my father had no other family. So his parents had both passed away. So he then became a solo dad with no support.
Who was driving the car, like a family friend or something?
I think it was a family friend. Yeah, correct, correct.
Imagine.
But it was an accident. It wasn't, they couldn't have been texting back then because there were no cell phones. No. So, you know, wasn't drunk driving, wasn't going too fast, was just that came around the corner and the truck just happened to be there. Slam on the brakes, but you can't not hit it.
And a 25-year-old young mum and wife is dead.
Correct. Exactly. So, and apparently.
And yet you believe in God.
I do indeed. Yeah. Yeah.
How do you explain that?
That's a very good question. Look, I think that I look at it thinking, we make the most of our own life. The thing with me is I was so young. One, I was pretty much unaffected as such because yes. I didn't know anything different. But what it did mean long term was I ended up getting brought up by my grandparents, not my parents. So there was generational gap.
I want to hear the God bit.
I came to God probably, I went to Sunday school as a kid. Came to God in my teenage years.
Okay.
So it's not I looked at that event.
But how could that happen? Who would do that?
Who would do what? Come to God.
Allow your mother to die.
Look, that's a very good question. And I sort of think if we get into religion, I don't ever blame an event on God. I don't think he ever causes an event. People cause the events to happen.
And then it's how we handle it.
And it's how we handle it from there. You know, I've certainly had a huge amount of
And that's where God helps.
It does, because I think you put your, well, for me, speak for myself, put my faith in God. I've certainly had some very rough patches in life. And it's nice to be able to turn to God, to put faith in God, and to really believe that the right thing's going to happen and something good's going to come out of a bad situation. Because what makes us as a person in life is how we get up after we fall down. So your dad is
in South Africa. He's got no family, and he's got a one-year-old baby girl.
Correct. Yes. Yes.
So then what happened?
So then what happened was he then found like a nanny, for lack of a better word, to look after me. So I kind of found these out years later, like a long time later, when I was in my 20s, and I went back and I sat down with him and said, okay, what happened? Explain your decisions to me as to once I became a mother myself. I was like, I don't know how he would have made those decisions. And he said, well, he had someone to look after me. And of course, he was at work. He worked. So he'd be at work from 6 o'clock in the morning till 6 o'clock at night, as a lot of working fathers are, and he'd have someone else looking after me. And then he said one day he got a phone call from my grandmother, being my mother's mother, who lived in New Zealand, and said, look, why don't you send Nicole to New Zealand for a little while, a few months, a year, till you get back on your feet, and we'll look after her. So he said, obviously, after a lot of thought, he decided that that was a good idea. Best I be brought up with family than a nanny as such. And that's what he did. So long story short, I never went back to South Africa. I lived with my grandparents ever since.
And did you see your father at all?
No. He came to New Zealand once when I was a teenager. I think I was about 13. And I went to South Africa probably twice in my childhood. And no, never saw him.
Did he get remarried?
He did. So as it turned out, his best friend, so him and my mother, his best friend and his wife were all very good friends. 2 weeks after my mother was killed in a car accident, his best friend Pete was killed in a motorbike accident. And about a year later, he and Colleen, being Pete's wife, got together. And some years after that, they got married. So, and they're still together today. They've been married ever since.
When you were a little girl, you're 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, you'd have a picture of your mother.
Yes.
A photo.
Yes.
You must have cherished that.
Absolutely, yeah. And my mother, people say I look exactly like her, exactly the same. And, of course, my grandmother had audio tapes of her as well because, of course, back then, yeah, if you'd make a tape rather than write a letter and send it off.
Post it.
Correct. So she had audio tapes. I could listen to her voice as well. And my grandmother, of course, was full of stories about what my mother was like. So absolutely.
When you were a little girl, wouldn't you have this huge gap? And you'd idolised what your mother would actually be.
Well, I think the interesting thing about that is I think I actually had a huge gap on a subconscious level, if that makes sense, because my grandparents I called mum and dad.
Okay.
And that's how I thought of them. But there's definitely a gap. And you see, this is where a Christian belief is great. I can't wait to go to heaven and meet my mum. You know, I kind of love being able to think about meeting her and finally catching up. And I also like to think that she watches over me and her grandchildren. You know, so it's nice to think that. But I guess the other gap too, on a subconscious level, was abandonment. I always wondered why my father didn't want me. And I sometimes used to think that I was a bit of a burden to my grandparents because my grandmother's sisters would say, oh, I don't know why she took a baby on that young. And, you know, as a child, you're very impressionable. You hear things like that and you come to conclusions that are not true at all, but you believe them.
And so you regarded your mum and dad, your nana and granddad, as your mum and dad, and so just sort of thought of yourself as having older parents.
That's absolutely right, yes.
Did they have other grown-up children other than your deceased mum?
No, they didn't.
Wow. So they'd done it really hard too. Oh, correct. My goodness. They would have loved you.
Well, you see, it was years later that when I asked my dad about, you know, why he sent me to New Zealand and never brought me back. And it was very interesting because he said, I tried to get you back, but of course he had to sign custody in order to send me there in the first place. And his side of the story was, well, then your grandparents refused to send you back. And he said to me, he said, I should have fought harder. He said, that's but my one regret. And it was really interesting because then for me, I thought, isn't that amazing? All these years as a child, I'd thought my dad didn't want me and I was a burden to my grandparents, even though my grandparents said, no, rubbish, of course they want you and no, you're not a burden. But to finally find out that actually both really wanted to keep me, and obviously 100% because I was my mother's only child and my mother was my grandmother's only daughter. Exactly.
Isn't it strange how growing up you don't think yourself worthy and not loved? Like, that's how I grew up, and I was the most loved kid ever.
Correct.
But you don't think of yourself as worthy of your parents, and it's a terrible thing. And like, nothing could be further from the truth. Exactly. But I guess it's because your mum and dad, and in your case, your nan and granddad, when you're a little kid, they tower over you and they know everything and you need them and they look after you. And you feel, oh, I'm such a burden. And even though they'd never hint of such a thing.
Yes, correct. They didn't.
No.
But it was like my
inside you.
Well, it's what you hear from other people. You know, like I remember when I studied psychology and the professor said, you cannot not screw up your children. You know, like the smallest thing will happen and a child will take it away. It's not meant at all. So it'd be like my auntie, in fact, more my great auntie being my grandmother's sister, would say something like, oh, I don't know why they took her on. It's, you know, such a burden at their age to suddenly have a baby. I'd never do it. And I would overhear that.
Yes. And it'd be the most blessed thing that ever happened in their life.
Correct. Correct. That's exactly right. Yeah. So
how funny we are as people, aren't we? How we see things. And I mean, you can have siblings who see the world completely different and kids think they were hard done by.
Yep.
I read a great book called Blueprint, and it was describing how they try and do this nature nurture thing. And the professor had discovered that you could ask someone whether they had a good, happy childhood or not. And it was entirely in the nature of the child, not the physical circumstances of their upbringing.
Correct. Right? It's how they perceive it.
So Billy Connolly had the best childhood ever. His dad was a total drunk, bit the nonsense out of him. And then I think his mum and dad deserted him. But he had a great childhood. And you can have a Meghan Markle type Hollywood princess who had a terrible upbringing.
Yeah.
Now, so you grew up with your nana and granddad. And I was asking you, obviously you knew you had a mother who had died.
Correct.
And I imagine being a bit Harry Potterish.
Well, I wasn't kept under the stairs.
No, but your childhood sort of fantasy not to have parents in a funny way and then to have them come and rescue you or have them come and they're just this amazing, amazing, amazing person that was your mum that you could never meet.
Correct.
Did you have that view of her that she was wonderful?
I still do, because if I talk to people who know her, everyone used to say how amazing she was. So she had half brothers and sisters. So my grandmother, her husband, being my mother's father, died in an accident when my mother was 14.
Oh.
So she got remarried to who I call my grandfather, and then my mother died. So my grandmother certainly knew tough life.
I don't mean to be rude, but there's a lot of death.
There is, isn't there? A lot. Exactly. So I'm not sure not I want to hang around
with, I don't want to hang around with you. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So consequently, my mother had half siblings, and they would always talk about how amazing she was and her friends, how she was such a wonderful person. When I went to South Africa and met my father's friends over there who knew her, they'd all say the same. Oh, she was wonderful. She'd always be waving across the street. What a wonderful person. So I still have that perception of her. And she was only 25, so she didn't have time to do much wrong.
How wonderful.
Mm.
But how sad.
Exactly.
But you will see her.
I think so.
Mm. My little son asked me, when I get to heaven, Dad, how will I recognize Granddad? But you got a photo of your mum, so you'll find her.
And apparently she looks exactly like me, although I will look a lot older than her.
Tell me, how did you then get into this property business?
Okay, so that's a really good question. So I had the recessive gene. So my grandparents were, like, I tell you what, I love rich dad, poor dad, right?
Yes.
My grandparents were definitely the poor dad mindset. You get a job, you buy your house, you work till you're 65, then you can start to live.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh my gosh, that's like forever. I want to live now. So I started to sort of read books and learn. And in most of the books I read, they talk about the fact that property produces the most millionaires. So I thought, well, if I bought some rental properties and held them for 10 years, I could sell half to pay down the other half, and then I'd have all this money. That was my
theory. What age are you when you started to think like this?
Teenager. So, okay, good idea. Yeah, teenager. So I sort of then started to go, well, how can I do this? And the interesting thing about it was I really did have drive and determination, because my grandparents were against it. You know, don't take any risk. Don't do that. I worked in the bank and they were like, stay there forever. That's what you should be doing.
Secure job.
Correct. So I had and good no benefit. Well, were there? Probably. In their
and
day.
You didn't. And you did, my dad's, his idea of a perfect job was one where you didn't get wet when it rained.
Exactly.
How old were your mum and dad compared to you?
My grandmother was 52 when I was born. So they were a similar age. They were 52 when I was born.
Jeepers.
So relatively young grandparents, and when you look at it today.
Yeah, but when you're 15.
They're in their 60s.
Yeah.
Correct. So yeah, you're right. So it's a big, even though that was relatively young for a grandparent today, it's a big generational gap.
Yeah.
So and very so different you, thinking.
Yes. And so here was you boosting.
Correct. Yeah.
So did you work at the bank?
I did. I got a job at the bank and I loved it to start with, and then I hated it. And what I discovered was all my colleagues were conservative, because bank, I didn't realize at the end, is all about risk. Mm. So I remember when I bought a house, I don't know if you should buy a house, they'd say. And I'd think, oh, well, everyone's telling me not to buy a house. Why? But I'm not sort of one to take advice from people who haven't achieved what I want to achieve.
So you bought a house when you were single working at the bank?
Yeah, I was, how old was I? I bought my first house, I was 22.
My goodness.
So, yeah, so when I bought my first house, correct. Yeah. I wasn't single. I was married. I got married at the grand old age of 18.
Goodness me.
Yeah, that was dumb.
Same guy?
No. He then decided to up and have an affair, and that was the end of that. So, yeah.
Did you kick him out?
I did. Well, I attempted to. Yes, correct.
So, and but you had no children?
No, we didn't. No, we didn't. So, yeah. So then I married Calvin, so my current husband, who I've been with for 23 years now, 22, nice. 22 years now. Mm.
So you bought your first house,
yes.
Kicked the husband out.
Yes.
And then?
We bought our first rental. So we bought our first house and our first rental together, kicked him out, and then the deal was he took the rental and I got the house.
Okay.
Yeah. So then it was a case of now we start again.
I think you wear the pants.
I do. Yes, I do. I have to admit it. My husband will say, yeah, control freak, bossy. That is me.
Yeah. So then you're working at the bank, divorced, but you got your house and a mortgage.
Correct.
Then what happened?
Then I decided I didn't like the bank anymore, didn't enjoy it. So I decided I wanted to be a trainer. I thought going on a course, when the bank sent you on a course, that was fun. So I wanted to get into training and development. So I tried to do that at the bank, but couldn't get into that job. So I thought I'll go find my own job in a training company, which is exactly what I did. So got into a training and development company, loved it. So that taught me a lot as well, because there was a lot of public speaking, presenting, running courses, and I'd learn the content of all the courses they had. So,
what sort of courses were you teaching?
So I worked for a company that taught things like customer services and report writing and strategy and all sorts. They had about 50 different courses, leadership, assertiveness, all of those sorts
Goodness
of things.
Me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I'm with you now. Yeah.
So that was cool. So I did that. And also they had offices in Australia. So I'd go over to Australia to run courses. And then they'd go into companies and run courses in-house for companies.
Mm. And would you describe yourself as a successful person? So you're working away there and you're quickly working hard, doing a good job and moving up.
Correct. Because then I got headhunted.
Okay. And you're married now again.
Was I? Yes,
I don't know.
I had. I was just thinking.
Hey, I know your life better than you.
Was I? I didn't get married. No, I was single for a very short period of time. I had a boyfriend, and I married Calvin after I got headhunted and started working for a company. Okay. Then I married him then.
Okay.
Yeah. Then I started my own business because that company went into liquidation. So I started my own business.
So you were made redundant?
Correct. Yeah, without getting any redundancy pay.
Was that a blow?
Not really. I looked at everything as an opportunity. You know, I always, as a kid, thought, I'd love to be my own boss. That's what I'd like to do. But I didn't know how to do that. And, of course, my grandparents were like, oh, no, that's risk. You want to stay in the bank forever. So they weren't very happy when I left the bank, but I was happy. So when it all fell apart, one of my colleagues in there said, why don't we start our own business? And I was like, all right. So we did. So I think the fact that it went under was brilliant, because I don't know if I ever would have started my own business. I don't think I would have resigned from a paying job to start. But because it went under, I thought, why not? And so
and
I started
presumably,
my own.
There were clients now without a business to deal
100%.
With. 100%. And you knew who they were.
100%. And I took the phone number. So I took that company's phone number.
How clever.
And an email. And then I just changed the name slightly, registered my own company with a slightly different name, and everyone would just phone because that was the phone number. And I would say, oh, no, they're not in the cut. They're in liquidation now.
But this
and then
me.
They're like, oh, all right, so I got all the business. Totally. Australia were not happy with me because I think Australia wanted the New Zealand business because Australia didn't go into liquidation. But they couldn't do anything about it because I wasn't using their name. I was using my own name. It just sounded similar.
How clever. Good for you.
Yeah.
And then what happened?
So that went really well. And then I started a little, still exists today, a company called BNI, you know, Business Networking Referral Group. And I thought, oh, I'll go along to them. But and I went along to a few BNIs, but it wasn't really my cup of tea. So my friend and I said, let's start our own networking group. So we started a little networking group. We called it NRG, Networking Referral Group. And we invited our friends, and that turned into a property group. So there was a mortgage broker, there was a real estate agent, there was a hairdresser who did property on the side, there was people who owned a stationery shop that did property on the side, and we ended up just talking property the whole time. And then it was like, oh, there's this course, you should go on this property course. And I was like, oh, all right. So I went on that, and it wasn't a very good course, but it was about $5,000 for the weekend. It's 500 people in the room from a business owner's perspective in training and development. I thought, these guys are marketing geniuses. How could I get 500 people in the room for a weekend at $5,000 a head?
I'm trying to carry the noughts. That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. And then they sold all their stuff in the room as well, tapes and books and CDs and mentoring and everything. So it's like, God, those guys made a lot of money. But anyway, property-wise, they weren't the best. So some of them were, but they weren't the best. And so, but I learned a lot. I'm always a case of learn what you can. Mm-hmm. And what did I take from it? So I learned to go make offers on properties. I learned to look for renovations. I never thought of that before. So I went out and did my first renovation property. Yeah. I made $2,000 because I didn't know what I was doing, and I made mistakes.
And did you renovate it yourself or get contractors? Sorry?
No. Well, my daughter was on the way. So I was pregnant with my daughter. Okay. So I didn't do anything much myself, except I put the rubbish in the bin. Mm. Halfway through the project, she was born. So then she was, you know, I obviously came everywhere with me. So I did none of the work myself. Yeah. And Jacob was 1.5 at the time as well. So he was, yeah. So it was pretty busy.
So now you're getting into property. You got your training business.
Yes.
And you're getting into property on the side.
Yes, correct.
I can see how all this works now.
Yeah.
But something went wrong, right?
Well, to start with, it was amazing. Like I did my first project, made a lot of mistakes, learnt from that. So I'm like, okay, this was what I did wrong. So I now know I do that. And this is what I did right. So, you sort of get better and better and better. Then I started making more money in property than my training company. So I thought, flag the training company, because it's also, I've got two young children and therefore I don't have to find a nanny when I'm off at the training company. Now I can just do my own thing in property. So everything went brilliantly until 2008. And then it crashed epically. Yeah.
What's your husband doing?
My husband works for FIFA. Oh, this time, back then. Back then, he worked for Spark. No, he didn't. Okay. Vodafone. It was Vodafone. He was in telco. That's right. Okay. He was a corporate account manager.
Okay.
Yeah.
So 2008, the proverbial hits the fan.
It did. Yeah.
And how did that have – so what was your problem in 2008?
So leading up to 2008, everything went spectacularly. I ended up working for a developer in Australia on a $1.6 billion development. So I overachieved. I was earning a lot of money. We'd bought 20-odd properties, and I was opening their offices globally. So I was over in South Africa at the time. I picked South Africa because opportunity to stay with my family.
Mm-hmm.
And when 2008 hit, everything went completely wrong. I remember I had to go to South Africa 3 months. I went via Australia. I met with the owner of the development. Are we all good? 2008. You know, yes, the company's solid. Everything's fantastic. Way you go. 1 month into it, my accountant rings going, oh, your mortgage is bounced. You know, and I thought, oh, that's funny. They must have put the money for my salary into the wrong account. So I ring up. The developers, no, we're not paying you. What? So they were affected by the GFC. They just didn't tell me. Cut all my salary off without notice. I'd put $120,000 worth of expenses on my card because we were opening the offices over there. They never repaid it. Lucky I had a return ticket home from South Africa. I remember I got off the phone and I cried. I'm not an emotional person. I cried. So my stepmother was there to pick up the pieces. And basically, I had a few deals that were signed in South Africa, and that would have pulled me out of trouble because they were still going to pay me commission. But I went to those buyers and I cancelled the deals. And I did it because it was not interest in the best interest of the buyers. So Australia was in trouble in 2008, as just about every company was, and about, I don't know, a number of developers had gone under. So what that meant is that the properties around, my developer I worked for didn't go under, but the ones next door did. Therefore, all of the property got devalued. Yeah. And I could not, in good conscience, allow my South African clients to purchase, knowing they'd have to take more money out of the country than they were allowed to by law to top up their mortgage on a property that had just devalued by about 30%.
Yes. You mentioned your stepmother. Is that a stepmother in South Africa?
Correct, because my father married.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Yes, yes, yes.
Yes, yeah, nice. Correct. Yeah.
So then what happened as Rodney's famous interviews proceed?
So I came back to New Zealand and attempted to pick up the pieces. So we were behind in everything. I had credit card debt. I had the debt collectors would be on the phone to me every few weeks. I was behind in the power bill, behind in everything. So long story short, we lost everything. Gone. Because I was unable to, I did another couple of property deals for a developer in New Zealand. They didn't pay me. And so therefore everything was gone. My husband is also a poor dad mentality. Love him to bits. He's back then, as are his parents. Mm-hmm. So they were like, just get a job. So I applied for a job and I got one. In a bank, in the training department in the bank. And so I thought, okay, I'll do it because it'll make my husband happy. And I was just about to sign the contract and they rang me and they said, oh, we've just done a credit check. It's like, yep. And you've got two defaults. And in my mind, I thought, oh, only two.
Sorry.
But to them, that was too many. And I looked into it, what it was. It was the Jolly Credit Card Company that that I'd had this $120,000 on. I had an agreement. I was paying it off, but they'd lodged a default anyway. And so the bank pulled the job. They were like, no, you can't have the job. So I stopped paying the Jolly Credit Card Company. I thought, blow you. You just cost me a job. I'm going to stop paying. And so therefore, once again, I had no choice. But I then said to my husband, well, I'm unemployable, so I'll go and get into property again because I know what I'm doing. I know what not to do. I'll have to go and start all over from scratch.
When 2008 hit, did you have investment properties?
Yes, we did.
And you lost them?
The whole lot.
And, of course, they were sold at a fire sale?
Correct. Yep.
Whoa.
Yep.
So you went from being a high-flying corporate lady doing deals all over the world, billion dollars, owning investment properties with money rolling in, $120,000 banged on the credit card for expenses, I'll claim it later from the boss, no biggie,
yep.
To nothing.
Correct. Absolutely.
And in fact, debts.
Correct. In fact, I look at it saying I'd gone down the drain.
Yeah, and two little kids.
Correct. And my grandmother at this stage was in her 90s and lived with us.
And a bit of finger wagging you felt, even though they didn't, because they're nice people, but sort of you flew too close to the sun.
Yeah, I think so. I think, well, you know what? No one had to blame me. I blamed myself excessively. In fact, my husband used to have to say, it's not your fault. But I just took a long time to forgive myself for losing everything.
How did you survive?
You know, and this is God. I was two things. I think the luckiest person in the world to have married Calvin.
Mm-hmm.
Calvin used to say, you know, when we first got married, whether you have a tin shed or a mansion, it doesn't matter as long as we're together. And when I go around the property investor associations and speak, and I said, just as well, because we had the tin shed at that stage, you know, everyone laughed, but it was. The kids were little, so they had no idea. In fact, my opening of my book says, what's for dinner? Can we do baked beans on toast again? Because we lived off baked beans. And it was funny, not so long ago, my daughter and I did a road trip to Massey University. And she said, and something came out about the book, and she said, oh, were we broke back then, Mum? I said, yep. She goes, oh, I thought you were just a super cool mum letting us have baked beans every day.
Isn't that wonderful?
So the kids.
So how did you make money?
So I had to start with no money deals because the banks were like, you know, don't even come in, just go away. And I had no choice but to do no money deals because I had no money. So that's exactly how I started. So I went to someone and sort of said, look, how about you give me a job as a property finder? Just pay me on commission. I'll just go and find properties for you to sell contemporaneously. And I talked them into it, and it's like, yeah, all right. So that's what I did. I started just going out there, started right back from the basics all over again, doing contemporaneous deals. And the first one I did, I made $2,000, and man, was I excited. I was like, I've just made some money. And that was with the property lifestyle way back and whenever that was. It was probably about 2014 by then. And I sort of went from there. So it was no money deals to start with. And then I finally got enough money to do my own property flip with a private investor. And then I made money from that. And then I finally got to the point where all the debt was paid off and the banks loved me again. And then I could do flips using banks' money. And then I made enough money to go and buy a rental property. And off we went from there.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's putting in the hard yards. And I tell you what I did to sort of get my mindset on track, because it's a tough mindset. You know, I 2008 to probably 2012, 2008, no, 2008 to 2010, 2 years, I worked my, can I say, ass off to try and save our properties, and I couldn't do it. So 2010 to 2012, I felt sorry for myself. And what I did during that time was I'd go and pick up the horse manure and sell it at the gate for $2 a bag. And then I finally used to get excited when I'd made $4 for the week. And I thought to myself, you know what? Selling horse manure costs no money because the bags are free. The twine to tie them up is free and the manure is free. So how can I go do no money property? Start making more than $4 a week. So, you know, but picking up that poo gave me all that time to think and to start to think, okay, right, come on. I've got to show my kids resilience. I've got to get back on the horse. I've got to get back into property. I know what not to do. So don't do too much bad debt. Don't leverage your properties up too high. Don't have negative cash flow properties, you know, and make and keep making the no money deals. Always keep your bread and butter. Do those four things as well. So that's what I did to build up to where we are now.
Do you think anyone can do what you did?
Anyone who's got determination, yes.
It's a funny thing, isn't it? Because you can't, I can't imagine living your life and you probably can't imagine living my life. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
But when you live your own life, you think, oh, yeah, no, that was nothing, right? Got through that. It was all a growing experience. And everybody, dang, to survive that. Oh, my goodness. But, again, it goes back to that beginning point, isn't it? You have to put yourself out there.
You do. And I think, and faith definitely helped me. Like, I can remember randomly opening my Bible and pointing at something, and it said, no matter what your circumstances, again and again, I'll send you aid. And so in my mind, it's like, okay, God's going to help me out here and I'm going to go do it. So anyone can do property if they're determined. You know, if they want to sit back and go, I don't want to put in the work or it'll come to me, then it's not going to work.
What would be, someone's listening to this not lots of people are listening to this, but let's say a listener's listening to this and say, you know, a bit of a rut, sort of just making ends meet. I'd like to get some property, get some assets behind me. What would you say to them?
The very, very first thing you have to do is get your mindset right. That's your absolute key. And I did that by books. So I used to like books like The Gap and the Gain. I liked Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
Yeah, it's a good
book. Of course,
book.
Now Property Quadrants, which is based on Rich Dad, Poor Dad's cash flow quadrants.
Yeah.
And I downloaded the Audible on my phone, and while I'm picking up manure, I'd listen, because it's really easy. Your mind will determine your actions. You know, if you get yourself in a hole and everything's terrible, that's what you believe. But if you get yourself into, okay, I've learnt from this, now I'm going to achieve something, that's what you believe.
Affirmation
is
the most important thing you can do in your life. And it's so easy to have the reverse. I don't know what the opposite of an affirmation is, but where you start thinking, oh, that won't work, or I'm useless at that, or I can never do that. Or, yes, I can do that. Oh, this, how will I do that? Oh, I can do this. And then you launch yourself off. And then you've, once you have jumped off the wharf, you have to swim. And that's the best place to be, isn't it?
Correct.
You have to swim.
Yep.
Standing on the wharf wondering whether you can swim, I suppose you've got to at least have a bit of dog paddle in you. Yeah, that analogy is probably not the best one.
Well, no, it's good because you're at the wharf. So, you know, if you don't want to go off in the middle of the ocean, but, you know, you can easily enough get dog paddle back to the wharf. Exactly.
Yeah. It is so, you know, if I could talk to my young self, it would be just jump in. You know, less hesitation, less thinking, less worrying. Just jump in and do it.
But I would say, to add to that, I would say teach yourself. So, you know, if we stick with your analogy, perhaps the first thing I'd do before I jump off the wharf would go get some swimming lessons.
Yes.
You know, or in these days it's easy. You can read a book on something. You can look at things online. You can join online groups. And then go and meet with and talk to people who are already there. So, you know, maybe jump off the wharf with someone who can swim next to you to give you a few pointers.
And a life jacket.
Correct. Exactly. Exactly.
We're speaking with Nicole Lewis. She knows what it's like to be up, down. And it's an amazing set of skills you've got in terms of education, training, and property experience at the high end and property expend at the mum and dad investment end. And you've put all those talents and skills together with your book, The Property Quadrants, and your seminars and your online tutorials.
Yeah.
Marvelous. Now, for people that are interested, tell us again, Nicole, where you go.
Okay, so a good place to start is the book, which you can get from propertyquadrants.com.
Yeah.
Or it's pretty much in any shop or online. It's both available Kindle, book, and audio. And then from there, and by the way, the book, it actually hit international bestseller in four different countries.
No way.
It did. Yep. Yep.
Overseas.
It did. America, Australia, Canada, and Germany.
Did you foresee that?
No way. No idea. Feedback from the book has blown me away.
You know, what year did it come out?
2023. The very, very end of 2022. So it would have been in the bookshops 2023.
It's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. So it's...
You're an international bestseller.
I know. It took me probably a year to work that out.
I assumed that it was just a book circulating within New Zealand.
Mm-mm, no. I get royalties every month from Amazon and Audible. So there you go. Not massive royalties, but some.
Goodness me.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, that book is definitely worthwhile.
I even had someone compare it to Robert Kiyosaki. They went, oh, it's just as good as, it's just like Robert Kiyosaki, but for property. I was like, oh, that's amazing.
It's the best thing, my hero, you say. So get the book, Property Quadrants, or at Whitkell's, and your web pages are NicoleLewis.com.
Yep, NicoleLewis.com, yep.
And PropertyLifestyle.com. Or,
yeah, the PropertyLifestyle.com, yep.
And you've had that a while.
I have, yes.
Your mother will be so proud of you.
She will, I'm sure, yes.
And in a way, you lived the life that she didn't.
That's true. Yeah. I don't know what she ever would have become. I don't know. But one day I'll find out.
Yes. And you've got two lovely children for her. And isn't it wonderful what you've done? You must be so very, very proud in a good way, because it's proud not for your identity, which I despise, but you're proud because of your achievement in many ways against the odds.
I think what really is my most thing I'm proud of is being able to help other people. You know, like, not only has the book helped a lot of people, because I've had so many people write to me and say, oh my goodness, I've read so many property books and this is the first one that actually tells us what to do, but also people we've managed to help. You know, we've got charities that we give to. Both of our children went on mission trips in Christmas last year. Of course, my mentoring clients have all been helped and they're now successful, and they can now pass on to other people. So if we all can help someone else in a little way, we're doing the best we can, I suppose, to try and make the world a better place, or our community a better place, which is why we're here.
How do you decide the charities that you'll support?
It's a very good question. I go with, look, every charity is amazing, and I just go with what feels right at the time. Like, I had a client, a mentoring client, start with me who worked at St. John, and so we decided to support St. John's, you know. And then I love my animals. We live on a little farm. And I saw an ad come on TV for the World Animal Centre, and it resonated. I don't even watch ads on TV. I was doing something else. I happened to look up, you know, I call it God. I saw that. It resonated with me. I got in touch with them, and I said, I want to start donating. So we donate regularly to them. So we support the people and the animals. And then we do the little things, you know, like you go to the supermarket and they said, you want to add $5 on for whatever charity at the time. Yes. What's $5? So if we always say
there was a time it was a week of horse poo.
Well, at one stage it would have been no, because I literally didn't have $5. One of the best presents my husband ever bought me was when we were really broke for my birthday one year, he bought me vouchers to go and get coffee at our local coffee shop. I was very excited. It meant that I didn't have to have instant for a whole 6 months. One of the best presents ever.
There you go. You're on Rattly Check Radio, Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. We've been talking to Nicole Lewis. What a wonderful, wonderful story. Property Quadrants is the book. The PropertyLifestyle.com is the webpage. There's also a webpage, NicoleLewis.com. You're thinking about property, I'd start there. Oh, my goodness. Imagine coming across that when you were aged 20, what you could do. Thank you so much for listening. Remember, you can send me a text 2057, email me, inbox at realitycheck.radio. Just don't think about sending me a text or an email. Do it. Thank you so much for listening.
If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.